If Jonathan Swift were alive today, his proposal for the universal use of Irish manufactures, in which he proposed that Ireland should boycott all English goods, well, I suppose it would make him rather less popular in England than, say, Mr. Cahill now, or that famous ogre of the 1920s, the mention of whose name used to frighten little children, the man who turned down the years into the benign Amon de Valera. Swift published his piece anonymously, and though a prosecution against him was started, nothing came of it. A few years later, Swift injected his bitter satirical talent with more acid still. There was a big to-do at the time. All this was something over 200 years ago. About the disproportionate number of children among the poor. Parliament had a debate about it to try and solve this embarrassment, the gist of which was that the poor really oughtn't to have so many children because it added to their general misery and it took away from their particular usefulness as 16-hour-a-day wage slaves. Swift contributed a damning suggestion in a famous pamphlet, which was called A Modest Proposal for Preventing the Children of Poor People from Being a Burden to Their Parents and to the Country. His modest proposal was simply that they should be fattened and eaten. Now, 200 years ago, satirists of this quality ran a constant risk of imprisonment on no other grounds than that they had offended the government in power. Today, in spite of a general howl on both sides of the Atlantic about the rush to curtail our liberties, we certainly, it seems to me, have more freedom to spout any opinions at all, even to spouting the need to kill your parents if you consider them to be bourgeois fascists. More freedom, I should say, than any two self-governing people have ever had in history. Art Buchwald, a name I hope is known to you, has been called the modern Dean Swift by no less an intellect than Mr. Dean Acheson, the former Secretary of State to President Truman, who, even in his late 70s, continues to look like a Spanish grandee in the full prime of his powers. Mr. Acheson does not exaggerate. Art Buchwald is a small, chunky, roly-poly man of swarthy complexion, black hair and eyes, glasses like goggles, and a sort of cocky rolling gait, like a sailor just come ashore and up to no good. Mr. Buchwald came to our attention in the years after the war when his paper sent him to Paris, and he wrote a column whose line was that of a latter-day Mark Twain, an American innocent abroad. But like Mark Twain, Buchwald was very far from an innocent, but he had hit on a humorous device of pretended innocence and bewilderment, which at one and the same time satirized both the American in Europe and the Europeans themselves. This has been a fairly constant vein of American humor. I remember Mark Twain, for instance, saying that the English were quite right not to have a laundry delivery service because your shirt was so starched that it walked back into your hotel room unaided. And there was Will Rogers, the old cowboy innocent. He was another. At the height of his fame, which was, I suppose, in the 1920s, he was invited by the then Prince of Wales, the present Duke of Windsor, to go to Lord's and watch a cricket match. Rogers saw the players eat a large and nourishing breakfast and then get down to business about 10:30 in the morning. He was just beginning to pick up the elements of the game when the players walked off the field, and he wondered what had happened, and he was told it was the lunch interval. To an American, a game is a furious contest, if not a bloody battle, and the sight of an American football or baseball team going off the field for refreshment, well, it would not be more surprising than the men in the Normandy invasion pausing on the French coast to have a hot dog and a Coke. However, Will Rogers settled down again to his cricket lesson at about 2:15, and then at 4:15 he was astonished to see the players walk off again. It was, of course, the tea interval. When the day was over, the Prince of Wales asked him what he thought about the game. He replied, "Your Highness, I think it's just fine, but if I were in charge, I'd line them all up before the game began and say, 'Now listen, fellas, no food till you're through.'" Well, Art Buckwall, for many years, had uproarious fun with the French and with himself as a supposedly and permanently bewildered American abroad. Then his paper switched his assignment to Washington. Everybody with any experience of daily journalism knew at once that it was a mistake. It may be all right for powerful authors like Ernest Hemingway to say, "Find out what you can do, and then do something else." But most first-rate journalists do one thing very well, and I think should devote themselves till the brain gives out, trying to do it supremely well. You know what happened? Buckwall took a month or two to get the feel of Washington and the complexities of the political system, and then he was better than ever. He has the acutest sense of irony and a gift for quite simple comic ideas, which he then writes straight, without any verbal decorations and adjectival fol-de-rols, the very opposite of highbrow wit. It was Buckwald who first suggested, 3-4 years ago, that the way to end the Vietnam War was simply to declare that the United States had won, proclaim a victory celebration, and bring the boys home to the blare of happy bands. I don't know how long it was after the Second War, 10, possibly a dozen years, I should guess, that he wrote a column containing his own modest proposal to bail Britain out of her recurring money crises and to save the United States the periodic embarrassment of having to put up the cash. What we should both do, he said, was to contrive, as soon as possible, World War III and arrange to lose it. That way, supposing we were fighting the Russians, they would then put up the money to reconstruct our entire industrial plant, which they'd destroyed along the most modern lines, and they would advance the loans or the outright gifts and send us productivity teams to teach us how to outproduce them. In a few years, the British and the Americans would be the most prosperous nations on earth, while the winners would be struggling with a ruble problem. Well, this jest has turned out to be too true to be good. Mr. Nixon's 10% surcharge on imports has dealt a blow to the Japanese, which is at once an open embarrassment and a secret relief to American businessmen. We've all wakened up too late to the fact that the Japanese were not merely constructing a co-prosperity sphere in Asia, but a Japanese prosperity sphere of the entire globe. In the guileless years a decade or so ago, we all found ourselves buying small, beautifully designed little radios of Japanese manufacture and then television sets, and saying to ourselves in a still comfortably condescending way, "Smart cookies, those Japanese." Today, there are full-blooded American patriots who could go through their kitchen and their living room and their garage and find that most of the products they need and use are either Japanese imports or are assembled in the United States from Japanese blueprints. 10 years ago, I went down to West Virginia to watch the making of a movie about John Brown, the liberationist who armed Negro slaves, was captured at Harper's Ferry and executed. He's the same John Brown whose soul, they say, goes marching on. Harper's Ferry is now a compulsory tourist stop, and attached to the inn there's a souvenir shop. I remember picking up a tiny gun and a Confederate hat, looking at them casually, and seeing printed on them what is, by the way, printed on the decorative ashtrays used on all American aircraft carriers, made in Japan. So even then the Japanese had taken out a patent on American history, both ancient and modern. Well, we were astounded to hear 3 weeks ago that the United States takes over 30% of all Japan's huge manufacturing industry. Nobody needs to be told also that Germany is the second most prosperous nation. No wonder I got the answer I did at a lecture before a California university audience a year or two ago, when I asked the assembled students which were our most dependable allies in the Second War, something that was over about 5 years before they were born. In a flash, a bright boy stood up and said, "Germany and Japan." And he wasn't being funny. It was an honest slip, but as profound as all such spontaneous slips are. Well, now Mr. Buchwald has written another column about the recent visit to China of one of the most distinguished, possibly the most influential, of American journalists, Mr. James Reston of the New York Times. Mr. Reston had no sooner arrived in Peking, this is the fact, not Buchwald's invention, than he was seized with appendicitis, and he was whipped off to hospital and had it out. The name of the hospital is the Anti-Imperialist Hospital. It does not require any cynicism at all to guess that Mr. Reston was treated as tenderly as Chairman Mao himself would be if he fell into the hands of his own medical butchers. Mr. Reston wrote several ecstatic pieces about the technical skill, the meticulous nursing care, the kindness and general charm and dedication of the hospital staff, for which we should all be grateful. He was restored to the outer world in fine shape, and such high good humor that his enthusiasm for Chinese medicine extended over several weeks to the people and the system. It's not unkind, I think, to suggest that Mr. Reston was given the full in-tourist treatment. His pieces brought balm to the souls of American liberals who begin to believe that the Chinese are, after all, probably just American Puritans 3 centuries later. It also brought great ire to the souls of the Republicans and conservatives. Mr. Buchwald, as usual, knew precisely what had happened to Mr. Reston and gave us cause to forgive him. The Chinese surgeons, Mr. Buchwald said, had inserted in Mr. Reston's stomach a tiny tape machine, which, whenever Mr. Reston was inclined to make nasty bourgeois comments on communist China, would cause him involuntarily to recite the thoughts of Chairman Mao. This explanation has released a gale of happy laughter in Mr. Reston's critics, dissolved their bile, absolved Mr. Reston of all charges of fellow traveling, and made us grateful yet again for the healing wit of Art Buchwald.